Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 30th, 2015, and welcome to episode 108 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and funding. With me today are two of our regular retro computer enthusiasts. On my coast of the U.S. is one Ken Gagne. How are you doing, Ken?
Fine, Paul. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm
lovely.
Fairly, for some reason, kind of mentally discombobulated, but I guess it's it's about to be the academic year and. Many too many things are going on.
I'm right there with you, sir.
Yes.
I have been stockpiling all the props I need for my first night of class, which includes a lecture on the history of the computers and the internet. So I have my 3.5-inch, 5.25-inch, 8-inch floppy disks, my punch cards, and my Apple I replica ready to go.
Awesome.
Yay.
And joining us from Sweden is Jack Nutting. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Paul. How about you?
Still discombobulated, but
still, I thought I was trying to give you an opening there, seeing maybe you've gotten better since the 2 minutes earlier. But no,
well, thanks.
But no, I'm fine. I have not been on the show in a long, long time. It feels like forever. Summer does that to me. It gets, you know, it stretches out, and I like lose track of everything. But I've been listening to at least some of the shows you guys have recorded, so I feel like I've still been spiritually part of the thing.
Yes, we could tell.
Yeah, I'm sure.
So for today's host topic, I wanted to look a little bit at the question of funding new retro computing projects. So as you're, you know, looking at your old machines, you may get a new idea for something related to retro computing, maybe some sort of new electronic peripheral, or maybe a new case, or maybe a coffee table book, or a history review or something. And, you know, it's a great idea. But it's expensive and you can't fund it all yourself. What kind of options are there? So we've talked about several, and there are several models. And I guess basically just I'm curious to hear what you guys think about, you know, what's been successful, what if you've tried something, what you thought of it, if you would try it again or never again, what you've seen that's successful, what you've seen that's not. So there are a couple of sort of obvious options. Relatively recently, there has been this. There are a couple of crowdfunding options. So Kickstarter is one of them, where you make a relatively polished proposal, and then people weigh in on whether they would fund you. And if you reach the goal, then you're funded. And if you don't reach the goal, you're not. There's another relatively well-known one, I think, Indiegogo, which is similar, except that you don't have to reach a threshold to actually go through. There's a regular kind of pre-order. Models. So, Ken, maybe you could start, since you are sort of the resident Kickstarter expert. What are your thoughts on that?
I would replace the word expert with addict.
Okay.
I've backed over 200 Kickstarters. It's definitely a problem at this point.
Whoa.
Yeah, and that's just the Kickstarters that have actually succeeded. I'm not counting the ones that failed. And as far as Kickstarters that fail, there have been many in the retro computing scene. Just looking at some from the past few months, we had the infamous Cinnamon 2 smartwatch modeled after the Apple II, looking for $150,000, and it got less than $3,000. That's in Australian dollars. There was the e-book, The Bride of the Wizard King, that used entirely images generated on an Apple II, looking for $12,000 Australian, got less than $800. And then back in the summer of 2012, there was Mr. Rob Tripp did the electronic version of What's Where in the Apple. He wanted to bring back that classic book as an EPUB and a PDF. He was looking for $7,500 and got just over $300. So those three projects, while they may have had some great appeal among the retro computing community, that's not sufficient mass and sufficient interest to generate the vast sums that a successful Kickstarter often requires. So I think if you're going to use Kickstarter, it needs to be a product that is of much broader interest. It can have its roots in retro computing, but it has to be accessible to the masses. So for example, if somebody wanted to make an Apple II interface card, you've immediately limited your audience to just people who actually have a working Apple II. If you want to do a documentary about the Apple II, then you're going to have a much larger audience of anybody who has a DVD player. And that's much bigger than people who just have a working Apple II. Maybe those people started their computing interests with the Apple II, no longer have one, but want to reconnect with it as easily as popping a DVD in a player or downloading an MP4 file. So that kind of project, I think, is much more likely to succeed. Where these projects should have gone, Cinnamon 2, Bride of the Wizard King, and What's Where in the Apple, as opposed to Kickstarter? I'm not sure. I think nowadays, if you want to be successful on Kickstarter, you have to either... Or if you want to be successful creating a new product, you either have to invest your own money, create a product that doesn't require much money, and or take pre-orders. And that's the end of my spiel.
So do you think that with the ones that didn't succeed on Kickstarter, you think that basically they were asking too much or overestimating the amount it would take? Or were they really just projects that are too big for the interest in the world?
I think for the Bride of the Wizard King, he was mostly using Kickstarter to gauge interest. I don't think he necessarily needed the money, and from what I've heard from Mr. Miles Stonecutter, who ran that Kickstarter, he does intend to publish the book eventually, even without the Kickstarter. That was just sort of his safety net of having some money with which to pursue this project. What's Where in the Apple, as was announced at Kansas Fest just at the time of this recording last month, is going to be released as an EPUB through Call Apple. So I don't know if funding was supplied by Call Apple or they were just able to modify the workflow to reduce the expenses, but that $7,500 either came from somewhere or was eliminated, the need for it. And the Cinnamon 2, that gentleman wanted to have sufficient minimum quantity to justify the run that would be needed for all this molding and production. And if you're going to just make a one-off, like using a 3D printer, I don't think he needed that much money. And to be honest, that's probably the level at which this product has appeal. Only 18 people backed this project. And the only reward level was $159 for a watch. So 150 divided by one. So he needed 944 backers, and he got 18. So... if he wants to sell to those 18 people, he has to re-examine his production process.
Yeah, well, I mean, and of course, right. You know, there are these economies of scale. You know, that if you know that you're going to be able to sell 100 of them, you can order 100, and it'll be cheaper to make. I can see that, but so a lot of people have actually gone, you know, with a kind of more traditional pre-crowdfunding kind of model, which is a pre-order. And of course, then there's a couple different ways that can go. Either you can just say, tell me if you want one, and I will make one for you, and then you can pay me when I'm done, or you can actually collect the money ahead of time to purchase the run. And I know if it were me, you know, I don't have a lot of, you know, sort of capital sitting around that I can pre-invest in something like this. So I know that if I were doing something like this, I would be very tempted to try to, you know, collect in advance. But there's, you know, big risks if things go slowly, or, you know, some cards get stuck on a ship coming from China, or, you know, whatever. So
I think one of the things that jumps out at me, and I'm definitely not a huge Kickstarter, what's the word you used? Addict. I've actually only backed a few things on Kickstarter, and it's actually, when I'm thinking back, it's mostly been like comic books. But I mean, I see all these things, and I think that, like you're saying, Ken, one of the big things is, you know, trying to judge if a project is going to be something that is useful to a small niche group of people or something that has broader appeal. Like a while ago, I was looking at this Arduboy. Have you seen this? It's an Arduino-powered tiny Game Boy-like thing, mm-hmm. Kind of the size of a credit card.
It rings a bell.
I think it was on here at some point in the recent past.
Yeah, I I think I may have mentioned it before a few months ago, but they met their goals in a humongous way, even though, you know, compared to the number of people who are actually playing with Arduinos these days, you know, that's kind of dwindling. I think they've been overshadowed by the Raspberry Pi so much, but still, as you know, as a cool sort of tiny project, I think one of the things is, it boils down to marketing in a way. It's about getting your message across. Like if, you know, if you have something that beyond whether it's something that appeals to a lot of people or not, if people don't see it, if you don't have a video that inspires people to say, hey, that's cool, and I'm going to share this with other people who might be interested, then it can, I think some of the things that could be useful to many people might die on the vine.
Well, and I think Kickstarter actually, so I have never investigated very deeply what it takes to actually put a Kickstarter together, but my impression is that there is this kind of a threshold that you have to meet. You have to put together some kind of video, and you know, I think there's at least a minimal review process before it actually makes it up on the site. You know, so it is kind of a procedure, you know, definitely a marketing procedure to set something like that up.
Yeah, and I think, you know, just some people are, you know, probably have better skills around marketing than others do. So, you know, you could have something that has a lot of potential, but if you're not good at getting your message across, you might meet the technical requirements for what Kickstarter says. Okay, sure, you've got a video that describes a product, that's fine. But, you know, if you're not presenting it well in your video, then you can be losing out on potential backers.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting topic. I too sort of feel like I'm not sure where to you know, like where I would come down if I were trying to do something. I suspect that anything I would be trying to make would be a pretty small audience kind of thing. But yeah, later on in the podcast here, I'll talk about the Uthernet 2 card, which has just recently come out for the Apple II, and that's being done through pre-orders. So, you know, ahead of time, they're just sort of collecting the money from everybody, but they got an idea, enough of an idea of what the sort of demand would be that they could predict the price. And I think that probably works pretty well. I can't remember exactly now what the card was, but there was some kind of clone of an accelerator, I think, that was, might have been the Transwarp GS, I'm not sure, but that someone was trying to put together, and this is probably like a year or two ago. There was a bit of discussion on the CompSys Apple II news group, and essentially what seems to have happened is that, you know, whoever was doing it kind of collected a bunch of money and then fell off the face of the earth, you know, and that's always kind of the risk with these things. And you don't want to be the guy who collected a bunch of money and then, you know, suddenly, for whatever reason, can't finish it. So, anyway, I don't know. I'm sure there are horror stories, and I'm sure there are success stories. I guess I don't really have any in particular to relate. But, you know, if people listening can think of some, you know, if you're either still angry and poor, or, you know, so have some thoughts about what worked really well, let us know. Anyone else have any other thoughts on this?
I will when we get to the news section of this episode.
Aha. Okay. A little teaser for anyone who is thinking of abandoning ship now.
Stay tuned.
That's right. With that brief foray into host topic land, I'll mention a couple of things that we got feedback from listeners on. So we got a couple of notes about the stuff on the last episode, 107, about where, you know, sort of retro-ness ends. So Alex sent feedback saying, you know, he's into Ataris and the Amiga 1000 and early Macs, attracted by the PowerPC era and the G5 PowerMac, and then iMacs are the end of his retroness. So, and Charles sent an audio response, which we'll cut in part of somewhere here.
Hey, RCR guys, just in reference to RCR 107. When I think of retro, I think of something that is at least a generation beyond simply obsolete or out of date. When it comes to computers, obviously, there's an obsolete period after which something simply ceases to be useful for productive work. But then after that, as it's collecting dust and getting older and, you know, maybe building up on nostalgia for people who used it, it becomes more of a retro item as opposed to simply old or obsolete. And we throw things out that are obsolete, but we collect things that are retro. So that's kind of my definition of retro. And that comes into play for you know, anything, any piece of technology, whether it's a computer or a car or even things like household electronics, radios, kitchen equipment, that sort of thing. So I think there's always going to be a sense of nostalgia for a certain generation of any given age. What they're going to be nostalgic for may not necessarily be the things that are mass-produced in the millions, like that anonymous Dell box, but the things that they couldn't afford when they were younger and had less disposable income, things that were maybe on the rarefied edges of availability. If you look at cars, for instance, in 30 years, there are still going to be people that are restoring and recreating the DeLorean, something that was a commercial flop, but it was just cool. And regardless of your age, if you ever saw one, you wanted one. I guess for a gearhead, maybe that's true. And then there's always the muscle cars from the 50s and 60s. There are people my age, and I'm not even 40 yet, but people that when they were growing up, they never had one. Their parents never had one, but it's a cool item, and it's gone from being out of date and, you know, the design language being obsolete to being something that's a nostalgic item for people who never even owned one. It's a classic collectible for anyone who likes design or mechanical engineering. And there's always going to be that sort of thing in computers as well. It may be something that we look at now and scoff at. Maybe there's a nostalgia for the old Palm Pilot or, you know, the Trio or things like that. When the iPhone is now ubiquitous, you know, we look back at where the sort of clunky beginnings of the smartphone and handheld technology. I certainly feel that about the Newton, even though I never owned one. I always wanted one. And now almost 20 years after they were discontinued, I have several that I've used from time to time as a daily driver for my personal information, you know, handheld, or fiddled with for hacking, built it out as a sort of the best Newton you could ever have bought for more money than, you know, than I ever had back in the 90s. So I think there's going to be a certain slice of whatever's current that will survive to be retro and basically have a life beyond simple obsolescence. It's hard to tell right now what that's going to be, because in 2015 there's smartphones and smartwatches and wearable tech and desktops and laptops that are made in the millions and, you know, make companies billions of dollars. But somewhere around the fringe, there's things that maybe we don't hear about as much, or maybe they don't get past the prototype stage, or it's something of a commercial flop for some company that, you know, we don't hear about until after the fact that, hey, this had some really cool technology, like a Betamax versus the ubiquitous VHS. And there's still a niche of people that collect and maintain beta tapes and recordings from that era and the machines that make it possible, just because it's a good piece of technology that didn't necessarily survive the revolution that came along after it. So that's my 2 cents worth of a voicemail. Anyhow, thanks for the RCR, and hope you guys continue for another 107 episodes.
And then Tony sent a link to something called, this is very Apple-centric today, but so Tony sent a link to virtualbasic.org. I don't think this is new. I think this is something that's been around for a while, but I hadn't really looked at it. If I had looked at it before, I've kind of forgotten about it, but it's basically, it's like an AppleSoft, so the BASIC and the Apple II, it's an AppleSoft kind of like preprocessor that you can, you know, you can sort of write a slightly more structured programs, you know, no line numbers and that sort of thing, and then send it through I think it's a Python script or something, and it will convert it into AppleSoft for you. So it's kind of it's an AppleSoft programming tool, but it looks kind of neat. I have not played around with it at all. There's some nice code coloring. So if you want to work in the retro language, but with at least a few kind of modern amenities, this might be one way to do it. And then, of course, AppleSoft is kind of slow. So you just prepare for your program when you're finished with it to not go very quickly. Okay, anyway, and I think we may have had other feedback, but as before, don't have it in front of me. So we'll anything we've missed, we'll try to catch up on in the next round. So now we can turn to the items of interest and news. And I guess, Jack, we can start with you. What have you dug up?
Oh, what have I dug up? Well, we've talked numerous times about the famous dig last year in Alamogordo, where a bunch of old Atari game cartridges were dug up from a landfill. And it was, you know, this was sort of talked to death quite a bit in the retro computing world last year. But there's some sort of outcome here. The city of Alamogordo, which actually put a lot of stuff up for sale on eBay, has kind of announced some results. They've sold items for $108,000 so far. That's having sold 881 games. Buyers came from 45 states and 14 countries. So it's not a huge amount of money, but it's something. And they have some more items that they are keeping in an archive, and they might sell them later, but they're not saying whether they will or not. They're saying, for now, we're just holding them.
I want to point out that I contributed to that total of $108,000, as anybody watching me at Kansas Fest discovered.
Okay.
I believe that Javier was in the middle of a presentation, and I rather unsubtly disrupted it by pumping my hands in the air saying, yes! Because I had to bid on like six different auctions trying to snipe one of them, and I finally got one.
Ah, oh, yes, I do recall that.
Okay. Was it an ET cartridge or something else?
No, it was an ET cartridge with box, and it has since arrived, but I have actually not opened the package that it came in yet because I want to do a unboxing video for my YouTube channel, and I just haven't gotten around to doing that yet, and I've had other priorities at them, but I will. And I'm also trying to dig through my parents' basement to find my Atari 2600. I'm not going to put the ET cartridge in there because if it suffered any sort of reparable damage, sending electricity through its circuits could permanently destroy it, and so I don't want to do that.
Right.
But I nonetheless just coincidentally do want to know where the heck my Atari is.
Right.
Have you seen your Atari today?
I'm going to put it on a milk carton. Have you seen my Atari?
Well, yeah, you probably do want to do the unboxing sort of soon before it becomes winter so that you can so you can do it outside.
Wait, do I need to do my unboxing outside?
Well, unless it depends on how much air freshener you have in your apartment.
Oh, I see.
Or how
see,
much
right.
dirt they scoop into the box with it.
Right. I usually do my unboxing videos in my studio, but you're right. I might not want to contaminate my house.
Excellent. Okay. Well, I was not super tempted myself to get one of these, but it's an interesting story, and I'll be interested to hear. It would be interesting to know if yours worked, but I suppose maybe there's some kind of like careful way you can test it electrically without necessarily running the full power through it.
Well, you know who did a great breakdown of the ET cartridge was Ben Heck. I believe he's been on this show talking about his Apple I clone, right?
Yeah, and in fact, I think he, when he was on here, as I recall, he had ordered but had not yet received his ET cartridge. So,
yeah, he did a really nice examination of the state of the cartridge he received, how to repair it, and finally, after doing all that work, he plugged it in, and it did work just fine, but I'm no Ben Heck, and so I think I'm just going to let my ET continue to exist in its current state after having been buried under dirt for 31 years.
Excellent. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I think you're right to let your cartridge remain dead and don't turn it into an undead zombie.
Yeah, I had a working copy of ET when I was a kid. I'm happy to let this one stay dead.
Yeah. Some things don't need to be revisited anyway.
Do we know? Are they actually hard to find? Not having been buried, I was sort of under the impression that they were not particularly rare. I mean, I thought that was kind of the issue, actually.
Yeah, I think they are not rare. I think they're pretty common, actually.
I find one on eBay right now with a buy it now price of $9.
Excellent. Okay, so you can have your buried one nearby and you know, fall into pits with the real one.
Yeah, if you want to get one that's new in box, there is one that's currently being bid at $55, and that ends in a few hours. But I guess technically the one I bought is also new in box.
Right.
Because that's the thing. These games were not like taken out of the box and destroyed. They were in their original shrink wrap when they were tossed into the Alamogordo landfill.
Right.
Yeah, I guess the concern with this was always just that, and I guess it's true. We've talked about this before, but I would think if you want to get one, you do want to get it like right from the source and not from anywhere else, because it would not be all that difficult for some less than fully ethical person to buy the $9 cartridge and, you know, like step on it and roll it around in the dirt and then try to sell it.
Well, the one I got, it did come with a certificate of authenticity.
Ah, okay.
And I also, they were selling some where the cartridge was still in the box and some where the cartridge had come out of the box. And I guess technically the former would be closer to its original condition, but I wanted to buy one where I could actually see the cartridge in the eBay listing so I could just make sure that there actually was a cartridge.
Right.
So that's technically the one I got.
Cool. Actually, Ken, while you're talking, you can continue with what I think we were teasing before.
Ah, yes. So, speaking of Kickstarter, there is a brand new, supposedly, documentary about the 8-bit generation of computers and their creators on Kickstarter. It is called 8-bit Generation, and it, let's see, let me pull up that Kickstarter, and it is asking for $27,740, or in other words, 25,000 pounds. By September 25th. It is currently about two-fifths of the way there. It's got just under $11,000 at this moment. And this documentary itself could make for a very interesting documentary because there's a story behind it. This documentary was pretty much filmed in the can and ready to be shipped more than 3 years ago. And I pre-ordered the DVD and then the online store, the distributor, the producer, the director, everything just disappeared. And this film was nowhere to be found. I emailed every address I had to try to get a hold of the guy, and there were no responses. It bounced. Since I had bought it on PayPal more than 90 days earlier, I couldn't get a refund. I was not protected through that. Jason Scott wrote a blog post where he lamented not the financial aspect of anybody who was out some money, but the fact that he had seen the footage for this film and it was beautiful and it featured legends of the 8-bit generation who have since passed on, like Jack Tramiel. So he was really concerned that all this footage just disappeared. Now, I don't know what's happened in the 3.5 years since then. I don't know who talked to who or what finances were involved. But the same gentleman who took my money 3.5 years ago is now on Kickstarter asking for more money. So I emailed him and I said, through Kickstarter, and I asked, your Kickstarter looks wonderful. I would love to back it, but I technically backed it 3.5 years ago. Am I going to get the movie that this Kickstarter is funding the creation of? Or could you refund me my money so I can consider pouring it back into the Kickstarter? And he wrote back almost immediately and said, some people did get a refund. I'm sorry that you're one of the ones who did not. You will be getting the documentary. No need to back the Kickstarter. And then he issued a Kickstarter update to everyone who had backed so far. And in fact, it wasn't just for backers. It's a public post saying also the same thing. Anybody who didn't get a refund will get their film. Now, somebody left a comment on that update saying, can you explain why you haven't told us that in the last 3.5 years and why you haven't answered our emails? So there's a little bit of there's some very legitimate grievances against this film, but the footage is gorgeous. The documentary looks like it should be great. It's been backed by Jason Scott on Kickstarter, and I have to hope that the creator of this film, I don't honestly think he is a scam artist. I don't think he took our money 3.5 years ago and is now trying to get more money. I don't think that's his intention. I think he's just a really bad businessman, but this could be a very good documentary. And so I backed it for £1 just so that I can make sure I get all the email updates and find out what is going to happen to this documentary that, let's see, is supposedly going to come out this coming January. Just 4 months from now.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
Well, it does say in the listing that in the risks, there are none because it's basically already shot. So,
right.
Yeah, I guess it seems like to actually go out and interview a bunch of people and make good footage, seems like a fairly poor approach if you're trying to scam people. So, and I'm really glad, particularly, like the footage of Jack Tramiel and just the stuff that was at risk of getting lost. I remember some of the discussion about this, I don't know what it was, 6 months, year ago or something. And I'm glad that it has actually come back to life. This might be like my third Kickstarter support.
Well, let me clarify. I don't think this is a scam, but I'm also not convinced that the director is actually going to get the documentary out on time this time. I think there is a small chance that whatever threw him off his schedule last time might happen again, because mm-hmm. If he's that bad a businessman that he's not replying to emails for 3.5 years, why should we trust him to get it right this time? So again, I don't think it's intentional. I don't think it's malicious, but there is cause for concern.
I guess the thing that I wonder about is if this film is mostly shot and mostly in the can, what is this actual cost that he needs the 25,000 euro for? Like, I'm not really sure. Is it last minute production cost to hire somebody to fix some things up, or it just makes me sort of wonder what is even.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's just a matter of human resources. If you are going to be editing a film Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, and it does take a lot of work to edit a feature length film, then he needs living expenses for that time. Maybe it's to buy the high end hardware and software he needs to do that level of editing. Maybe it's to hire a professional, because maybe he's just a director, not an editor. You're right. It does, as Paul said, say in the risks and challenges, all interviews and additional footage are already shot. We just need to pack everything in an awesome documentary. Now, I don't know if he means pack as in physical packaging like a DVD, or if he means package as in the film itself, like the package of all the footage he shot into a 90-minute product. So, but you can back it for £25, which is about $28, and get a download of the film in January 2016. Or, let's see, where's the DVD level? Actually, I take that back. And looking at the reward levels, there is no DVD listed whatsoever. So I guess there is no physical packaging. Okay, so it's just a digital download, as opposed to an analog download, I guess.
Right.
Interesting.
Those are the worst.
Well, whatever happens, I am looking forward to seeing the interviews. So I hope this does actually make it through to the light of day. Oh, I know what I was going to say. I don't want to necessarily, be a complete apologist or whatever. I think, I can totally understand, once you miss the deadline, kind of feeling like embarrassed to talk to anybody again. But
yeah, we have a few people in the Apple II community like that.
Oh, I think definitely there's people just in the world like that. But
true. I shouldn't limit myself.
All right. I guess I need something. My item is something on Blondie Hacks. This is Gwen Dunkey's site. She's just done a post on an Apple II ROM dumper, and it's a sort of Apple II related, and it's toward the goal of looking at the ROM contents of the latest in the Apple II line, the Apple IIc Plus, which is something that it wasn't around all that long, and so there hasn't been the same kind of investigation done of the ROM that was in it, and so she just kind of wanted to look at that. But the post that I'm linking to here doesn't really have that much to do with the Apple II itself. It's more about her going through the process of building a ROM reader. So she's going through. She talks about how she laid out a PCB to communicate over USB, sort of serially, the contents of the ROM and places where it went wrong. And anyway, it's a neat thing to read, and it's got enough technical detail that you could, including the schematics and stuff, you could just follow along and do it yourself if you wanted to. But I think it's kind of neat to see, sort of how you connect up the USB to this reader. Part of this was inspired by a project that I was just thinking of. Why was I thinking of this? I guess it was on one of the Facebook groups. Someone was talking about making a kind of a Lisa emulator running on a Raspberry Pi, but in the shape of a Lisa. And there was some discussion of the keyboards, and it led me to think, actually, one of the things about the Apple Lisa is that the keyboards have these kind of like foam pads under the keys. And there's a number of computers that had these. I think Compaq, I don't know. There's a number of keyboards of the era that had this, where basically the keys were returned by the kind of the sponginess of the foam. So it was sort of essential for to use the keyboard. And over these years, the foam has degraded. So almost all of the Lisa keyboards by now have at least some keys not working if you haven't actually made new little pads. And so I was thinking, well, it would be kind of neat to make a some sort of thing that would actually allow you to plug in a USB keyboard to the Lisa while you wait, and you know, to get around to fixing the foam pads on the actual Lisa keyboard. And I thought enough about it just to try to realize, you know, like, it probably wouldn't be a very complicated project if you can, you know, if you had some sort of microcontroller communicating with USB. You know, modern ones would probably have some relatively straightforward way to do that. And then the keyboard itself is actually just one of those like quarter inch headphone plugs. I don't actually know how the signal gets across, but it's you know, it must be just basically like a modem, you know, sending timed pulses across it. So I was kind of thinking that would be kind of a neat project to do. This is a very long tangent, but and you know, looking at Quinn's site sort of made me think, you know, this might actually be like the pieces that one might need to put that together. So it's interesting in its own right and in its own context, but it's also kind of a neat piece that you could conceivably use in something else. So anyway, that's about all I had to say about that. Did anyone else look at this?
I back Quinn on Patreon, so I got the link, but I haven't read the entirety of her blog post yet. When I saw it was a ROM reader, I was reminded of Sarah Shepard's GS ROM Grabber, which was a software program that just makes a ROM image off an actual 2GS that you can then use with an emulator. Obviously, what Quinn is doing is very different, being a hardware project, but just from the headline alone, that's what it made me think of.
I just quickly scrolled through this thing, and I think it's always interesting when people decide to tackle what is essentially a solved problem in a new way, just for the fun of doing it. That's, you know, this is exactly the sort of nerdy thing that I love. Like, there's no reason to actually do this necessarily, but it's a very cool project to follow through and to sort of see how it's done. So,
yeah, I think one of the comments there at the end is sort of like, you know, isn't this ROM actually already out there on like the archives? It's like, yeah. I don't know. I don't care. That's not the fun part.
Yeah, and the point of, you know, once this, you know, with this thing existing in the world, that means that if some other, you know, some oddball machine turns up that has a different ROM in it, it's trivial to then capture what's on that ROM. So,
yeah, and if you wanted to capture, you know, I know the Apple II kind of best, and if you wanted to capture the ROM in that, like the sort of the system ROM, it's actually not difficult at all, because you just sort of read that area of memory and write it back out. There are definitely some ROMs on cards and things like that where they're not actually in the address space, you know, so there's no way that you can say, tell me what's on the ROM just from within the computer. So, and I mean, you know, sometimes you can do kind of funky things like take the ROM out and put it in place of one of the actual ROMs of the computer so it is in the address space briefly.
Ah, sure.
But still, this is, you know, this is a kind of more general solution. Okay, let's see. Cool. What do we have next? Jack, I guess you're up next with a happy birthday wish.
Yes. I want to say, of course, happy 20th birthday to Windows 95, everyone's favorite version of Windows. Am I right?
Windows 95.
Windows 95, I didn't use it much. I used it a little bit back at that time. I guess in those days, I was actually mostly doing Next Step stuff, so I wasn't really, you know, Open Step, and I wasn't really in that world at all. Although eventually I did have a PC that I had Windows 95 on, and it was for sure better than, like, Windows 3.1 in terms of its user interface. And I think, you know, there was the common joke that Windows 95 was, like, Mac 89 or whatever, which is pretty... I think was pretty correct in some ways and also wildly incorrect in other ways, because Windows 95 was surely much worse than what the Mac had in 1989 in almost any way that you could measure. But you know, I think it was, you know, it was pretty important in the sense of that many people who got on the internet for the first time in the mid to late 90s, they were using Windows 95. This was, you know, sort of, there was a huge number of people who got cheap PCs running Windows 95 that, you know, those same people would have had a harder time handling Windows 3.1. So I think it is an important milestone in the history of Windows, even though I don't really care much about it.
Yeah, for me, definitely this, I feel like most of my kind of introduction to Windows was with Windows 95. I think I kind of interacted a little bit with 3.1. And by the time we got to Windows 98, I was not as much in the Windows world. I mean, I was never that much in the Windows world, but the most interaction I probably have ever done with Windows was with Windows 95. So it has, I mean, it has sort of a, I have a kind of a visual nostalgia for it, I guess. It had a look to it that was not matched by Windows 98 or 3.1.
So anyways, that was, this was 20 years ago. This was widely reported everywhere, saying happy birthday, Windows 95. There's another birthday that I wanted to point out. So on the exact same day that Windows 95 was released, Atari, who, as everyone knows, was doing great work with their marketing and sales all throughout the 1990s, they released the Jaguar CD on the same day. And I remember this because I owned an Atari Jaguar, and I remember this clearly happening. Although when I look now and I look on Wikipedia and stuff, it says that Jaguar CD came out a few weeks later. But I remember that they had the exact same release date, which was, you know, sort of a classic terrible mistake to release your product the same day that Microsoft is releasing something enormous. So,
well, maybe they just
there you go.
Had a do-over or something. That's a little bit disturbing, actually, that you have this clear memory of them being simultaneous and yet all the online things.
Wikipedia says that it's a different date, and everything that they have citations showing a different date. I found one website somewhere that actually listed the same date, the correct date, but it doesn't really matter in the long run, I suppose. But I actually never even went and bought an Atari Jaguar CD, although I did have Windows 95 eventually, so I guess Microsoft won.
they passed the jack test.
Microsoft won over Atari. There's a newsflash for you.
Cool. Yeah, I even don't have a particularly good concept of what the Jaguar CD is. Is it a computer or a console?
No, the Atari Jaguar was a game console that they released in 1993 or 4, I think. And then they came out with the CD attachment later. So the original Jaguar had just a cartridge port for the games. And that could only hold, I think those games could hold 4 megabytes maybe at the most. 4, 8, something like that. And they wanted to be able to produce some bigger games. So they made a CD unit that you would sort of plug into the cartridge port. And then it had a pass-through port, so you could still play cartridge games with the CD unit plugged in. And the CD was sort of a top-loading thing with a lid that flipped up, and it quickly sort of became referred to frequently as looking like a toilet because of the way the CD compartment opened up. So kind of a, I don't know, interesting product. One thing that was pretty cool about it, it had a thing called the Virtual Light Machine, which was made by Jeff Minter, who, as everyone knows, has gone on to do a lot of other things, but has often had a penchant for trippy visuals powered by music. And so that was one of the things that was built in the Jaguar CD. If you put a normal audio CD into it and close the toilet lid, you would get a nice trippy visual thing going on your screen.
Cool.
So.
And have you heard about the new console that's being molded after the Atari Jaguar?
No, oh yeah, what was that? I do remember that.
So the the publishers of Retro Magazine are releasing a brand new offline cartridge-based video game console, and to save on startup costs, they were able to buy the cases and molds for the original Atari Jaguar and its cartridges. So this new system they're releasing will have original internal circuitry, but the outside case looks exactly like an Atari Jaguar.
Yep, I do remember seeing that in the past couple months sometimes. I forget what it's called. We're calling it the VGS or something?
Exactly, the Retro VGS, and they are going to be launching a Kickstarter for it the week of September 14th.
Looks kind of interesting. I also remember that in this same discussion, someone pointed out that the Atari Jaguar case moldings had also been used to produce some sort of dentistry equipment. So there's some like dental equipment that dentists buy but it was actually mounted differently. So it was meant to be wall mounted, so it was turned up vertically, and it was produced in white instead of black, but the same exact look as the Atari Jaguar.
Yeah, I just found a YouTube video called Atari Jaguar Dental Machine.
Perfect.
And just like you said, it's white, it's still in the shrink wrap, and here he is basically doing an unboxing, and I don't think whoever shot this video is an actual dentist, so I don't think he can show it to us in use. But yeah, that's a Jaguar, all right.
Yep. Yeah, and actually, the Retro VGS looks pretty interesting. Among other things, it has both USB ports and it has traditional old Atari 9-pin DIN ports for joysticks.
Fascinating.
Cool.
Yeah, by the way, that dental equipment was used by Imogen Systems because they found it to be just the right size for housing their hot rod camera, according to Wikipedia. The game cartridge molds were reused to create optional memory expansions.
Hmm.
Atari Jaguar revived as dental camera. Oh, that poor Jaguar. Like, I would be so embarrassed if I was a Jaguar.
Well, it seems kind of weird that it would actually be more cost-effective to just to recycle a mold like that. But interesting. Cool. Well, we'll find some links and put them in here.
Yeah, and in a few weeks when the Kickstarter launches, I'm sure I'll be discussing my addiction once again.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so Ken, you have the next thing. Something about the source?
Yes, so this is something I teased a month ago the last time I was on RCR, and I hope that it's okay for me to do a little bit of self-promotion. But I said that there would be a new product coming from Juice GS, and by the time this podcast airs, which I hope will be on or after September 1st, we will have announced that GameBits, the publisher of Juice GS, will be adding to the Juice GS online store two products from The Biteworks by Mike Westerfield. Those will be Opus 2, the software, and Opus 2, the source. These are compilations that were originally released in 2000 and have since been sold by The Biteworks and Syndicom. The software is a collection of basically every product ever released by The Biteworks. And The Biteworks is a voluminous developer of programming tools for the Apple II. They created all the Orca suites, so like Orca Pascal, Orca C, Orca M. They released a series of learn to program tutorials in those languages, including the toolbox. They released GSoft Basic, Quick Click Calc, Quick Click Morph, and a bunch of other programs. So the software is all those programs, and the source is the source code for those programs. We're going to be selling them as a downloadable product for $25 each, or $40 for the pair. You can also, for a slight additional fee, get them on CD or on a Juice GS branded 8GB USB 2.0 thumb drive. And finally, since Juice GS is traditionally not in the business of selling either software or other people's products, there is a tie-in here. Now, GSoft Basic was actually shipped, a free trial version of it was included in the December 1998 issue of Juice GS. So this partnership goes well back. And the reason that that free trial was included in Juice GS is because Eric Shepard wrote this great six-part series that ran from 98 to 2000 about learning to program GSoft Basic. And this way, every subscriber to Juice GS had a version of GSoft Basic they could use to follow along with his tutorial. They didn't need to go buy the full product. Everybody could follow Cheppy's tutorials using the 3.5-inch floppy disk that was provided. So we have taken that six-part series and relayed it out as a brand new PDF, included some original commentary from Mike Westerfield, and have bundled it together into a 49-page PDF, which is going to be sold separately for $10, which includes that same free trial version of GSoft Basic. But when you buy either of the Opus products, you get that PDF completely free.
Cool.
Yay.
Cool. Very nice.
So if you have been wanting to get the Opus products and you have found them difficult to purchase, this is a great opportunity to finally get your hands on them at a dramatically reduced price. When these things first came out, they cost at least $100 each or $200 for the pair. And now you can get the two of them for $40 downloaded to your hard drive today.
So when I was actually doing kind of development, I don't have a history with the Orca products themselves, but I had heard of them, and I was thinking at some point about trying to get a hold of them. I think it's interesting. I just fairly recently came across the fact that there was even an Orca integer basic. You know, so there's a Pascal and there's a C, and some other ones as well, but it includes the basic that was shipped on the original Apple II, which is sort of surprising. But it's neat that this is actually, that the source is still around and it's still able to be distributed. I could imagine that might actually be kind of an interesting source code to look through, just to kind of see how to do language parsing and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and now you can.
In a small space.
Yeah, it's great that the ByteWorks and Mike Westerfield have held on to that source code for all these years. I think some Apple II users are really good about being forward-thinking and holding on to their source code. I mean, the ByteWorks has been around since 1981, and he saved pretty much everything ever. And not only for potential future development and products, but also eventually to release it to the public so that they could use it as they see fit. Which is remarkable, because GSoft Basic has been the foundation for a series of products he has since released for even iOS, which includes Tech Basic. And he talks about that in his commentary in this PDF. So some iteration of GSoft Basic continues to be used and commercially available to this day. And it's great to go back to the source, to the roots, the origin, and be able to get the Apple II version.
ByteWorks basically was an Apple shop, though, right? I mean, like, these developer tools weren't ported to any other platforms, right?
I mean, as far as I know, yeah, you're correct, but if you go to www.byteworks.us, that is the same company that created all these Apple II products, and you can see everything that they sell nowadays for a variety of platforms. So they are still around mm-hmm. and using the descendants of their original products, but you're right. As far as I know, Orca itself was not ported to non-Apple II platforms like C64 or Atari.
Interesting. So one of the things that I came across here when I was kind of, looking at Wikipedia, is that they actually, I didn't realize that, but they actually seem to have been the people behind the APW, which is the actual official Apple Programmers Workshop tools that were used on, I guess probably later GS, but definitely the Mac era.
Yes, as far as I know, that is correct.
Neat.
Now, these products are ostensibly sold through Syndicom as well, and JuiceGS and GameBits have a non-exclusive contract with the ByteWorks, so they will continue to be listed with Syndicom as well, and it's possible that the ByteWorks might have future partners in works. But in the meantime, you can definitely get them from us. Yay.
Excellent. Okay, let's see. So I think it's me now. Yeah, so I think I mentioned this, actually, sort of alluded to this in the outro of the last one, but so whenever we close the episode, we say, please write us a review on iTunes and, all this stuff. And took a look at some of the reviews on iTunes, and they said, how about something else other than Apple II? And you can look forward to that in episode 109. But my next item here is the Ethernet 2 is available for pre-order now. It's a Ethernet connector for the Apple II, so more Apple II. But this is really quite interesting. I never had... So, Ken, you have some experience with the previous iteration of this, right? The Ethernet, the first Ethernet?
I did have an Ethernet that was given to me as a gift by Sean Fahey, and I had it installed on my Apple II GS, and I blogged about how I got it up and running on the Computer World network, which was a great way to run ADT Pro. But then when I moved jobs from Computer World to MIT, as you can imagine, MIT has a much more stringent security measures, and their network is locked down in a way that will not permit an Apple II online. So that is sad. But I have ordered an Ethernet 2, nonetheless, because I don't expect MIT to be the job I retire from.
Yeah, although, and I guess Ethernet will be around for a little while longer. But, so this is, and I actually honestly don't know that much about the card, though I have also ordered two, in fact. This is Glenn Jones' A2 Retro Systems. It's the second iteration, and I think it's not directly compatible with the one that was called Ethernet, so this is Ethernet 2. There have been some updates and changes to it. It's actually, at the pre-order price, it is really quite cheap. It's only $59 per card, $10 flat rate for shipping for one or two cards, and that's crazy cheap. So I don't know, I'm not sure exactly how many are being anticipated sold, but I think it's probably... In the posting about this on A2 Central, there was a mention of there being 277 respondents to the survey of, what kind of color you'd want and that kind of thing. There you can get this in several different colors. So if you're kind of a neurotic collector. You can get them all. So I'm kind of looking forward to, I kind of wanted to get two just so that it would be possible to set up like, you know, two computers to talk to each other at least. But I think this is priced cheaply enough that I think there are going to be a lot of them out there. And that kind of opens up an interesting kind of possibility for games that are on retro hardware, but are multiplayer games that are, you know, like communicating over the internet to other people on retro hardware. And I actually also it would be interesting to see if, so I don't really know what the status is of kind of Ethernet connectivity on other platforms. Although I think actually there was maybe, I'm not remembering this exactly, but I think maybe at the last VCF East, there was some kind of roundtable about this, possibly centered around, yeah, I think it was actually supposed to be kind of like a multi-platform discussion. Anyway, I remember a little enough about it that I can't really say anything more about it. You know, now that this is done, it's relatively cheap. It's possible that we might be able to take elements of the design or carry that over to other computers as well. So I think this is kind of an interesting step forward, and I think it's actually made possible. Or the thing that's going to be sort of making this step forward possible is that it really is surprisingly cheap. I mean, this is something that pretty much everyone can get.
Yeah, it is ridiculously cheap. I can't believe that's only $59, and I think it's great that right when you go to buy it, he asks, do you want 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 Ethernet 2s? Because you can get that many at this price. I mean, like, you can't have just one.
Right. But so, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what gets developed for it. I know there are a few, you know, sort of software packages. I think Contiki is an operating system that I believe is compatible with this, and I think David Finnegan has written some kind of TCP/IP software called Marina that I believe will work with this as well. And so it kind of opens up a new area to develop in.
Yep, I think this is pretty interesting. I guess the thing that I was wondering about when I read this is, you know, which you just mentioned, the availability of some sort of TCP/IP stack. Because I guess that's what I've heard as the main objection to actually putting any kind of 8-bit computer on the internet is the fact that just TCP/IP itself typically requires a fair amount of CPU and a lot of space, just the code itself. I don't know if it requires, probably requires a fair amount of RAM for buffering, but also just, you know, the actual program to actually do TCP/IP is not trivial. So it'd be interesting to see how this is solved, to follow up some of this and see what is out there.
Yeah, and now that you mentioned that, of course, there, you know, like all kinds of concerns leap to mind. Like, at least particularly like web protocol stuff is moving further and further away from connections that can happen without encryption.
Right.
And encryption is not the kind of thing you want to be doing at 1 megahertz. So
preferably not.
That could be a limiting factor as well. You know, you can talk to, if you write a little chess game or some sort of Bile-Stowed game or something where you're actually playing a game with somebody over the Ethernet, that's one thing. But, you know, if you're trying to write a web browser, you may be limited to a very small number of sites. Actually, the price is going to be, the cheap price will be over by the time this gets posted. Anyway, once we have them in our hands, there will be more discussion, I'm sure.
Yep.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
It used to be difficult for personal computers to do more than one thing at a time. Starting with Windows 95, it's easy. Start multitasking. Start Windows 95.
Le train de l'avenir, c'est la micro-informatique. Avec la micro Thomson, donnez à vos enfants une chance supplémentaire de réussir. Offrez-leur un cadeau intelligent. Le nouveau Thomson MO6, puissant et facile à utiliser. Il a plus de 1000 logiciels en français. Micro-ordinateur Thomson, des cadeaux intelligents.
And you are?
This is Jennifer Aniston. I'm Matthew Perry. We're here to see Mr. Bill Gates about a possible starring role in the video guide to Microsoft Windows 95.
He's out right now, honey, but you can wait in his office.
Clapping.
Oh, we thought it was customary maybe to clap when entering Mr. Gates' office.
I was just turning the lights on.
This replaces Program Manager in the old Windows. It's way better.
Well, what happens when you, like, had the old Windows and then installed Windows 95?
That's a good question, honey.
Okay, and where is the button that instantly kills anybody that calls me honey?
Okay, and we're back. First, we'll begin the spending money portion of the show with the retro computing gift idea. And in honor of the release or the announcement of the Jaguar CD is a start menu shirt. So it's a t-shirt, basically, you know, it's what you would think. It's a t-shirt that has the Windows 95 style start button on it. So if you want to celebrate Windows 95, then this is for you. It's shirt priced, you know, it's $22. Oh, and I think maybe it comes from Australia.
Actually, for me, it says it's $23.12.
Well, maybe it's using, you know, whatever that is, the Pentium 2 or...
They've got the Pentium bug. It can't calculate the price properly.
Right.
Very authentic.
Anyway, so, yes, if you have a Windows enthusiast among your retro computing circle, then this might be the thing for them. Okay, so now we can turn to eBay. And Jack, I'll let you start here. What have you found on eBay?
Well, I think everyone who's listened to the show in the past and heard me talk about stuff on eBay knows that I like Atari stuff, and I like belt buckles. And especially when Atari is combined with belt buckle, you just can't go wrong. And I found another one. I've never seen this one. It is labeled Atari Old School Video Game Console Retro Joystick Metal Belt Buckle New. And what this is a belt buckle, which seems to have a depiction of the classic Atari joystick and an Atari logo. And it seems to have an attached piece of cardboard that has Atari labeling. It looks like the kind of thing where probably this was like, the cardboard was used to hang this on a display somewhere. It's got a little hole where you would hang it on a thing. And somehow I just like kind of the sort of obscenity of having the joystick near where a man's joystick was located in terms of a belt buckle. I just find this great. And it's got a buy it now price of $10.99, and it's only got 3 days left in this auction, which at the time we're recording this, it might still be going by the time this episode comes out, or it might have been purchased by me. So, in any case, even if I do buy it or someone else buys it before that, and you should check out the similar links that are shown below this, because there are plenty of other Atari joystick belt buckles, believe it or not, that are out there. So some are even more inappropriate than this one.
I must admit I have not kept up with all the various iterations of the Atari, you know, the Atari clothing options, but I had not seen this before.
Nope. Me either. I like, especially it's got the little red button.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it has this one little dot of color on it. It's very, very cool.
Almost looks like it's painted like nail polish. It's like a little bloop.
I can pretty much guarantee that if I had this, I wouldn't wear it. But I might display it.
Good to know.
Let's see. Ken, you have a surprising choice here.
Oh, Paul, your sarcasm is adorable. I don't spend that much time on eBay, to be honest. I'm one of those precision shoppers or something. I don't know what you call it. And surgical strike shoppers. I go on eBay looking for a specific thing, and if I don't find it, I go get it somewhere else, which doesn't really make me all that great a contributor to this segment of the show, because I had to go looking for something that I would actually buy, as opposed to just something I thought would be interesting. So I found on eBay Microzine volumes or issues 8 and 9, which I already own, but what I found interesting was that they appear to come in some sort of joint packaging for the two issues, which I've never seen before. I have, as Paul has seen, some sort of a plastic bin that holds the first four or six issues, but this is for issues 8 and 9. So I'm not exactly sure what is going on here, if this was how they were actually sold, or if this was some sort of a special bundle, but it's a large gray box with a lid on the top. So you keep the games in there when you're not using them, and you just pop the lid off to pull them out. And looks like the photo implies that he has like three of these, but the auction is only for one of them. and he is asking a buy it now price of about $24. And I've actually purchased from this seller before. I didn't realize that. He's a good guy, and he listens to podcasts like ours. Mm-hmm. So he's legit.
Yeah. I noticed that too. Actually, I think so. When you look at the picture that you thought implied there were three, I think is actually just the box sitting on the two that were inside it. But yeah. So
I see what you mean. Yeah, that does look right. Okay.
So Microzine, since you didn't say what this is, Microzine is was a Scholastic publication for kids that was basically just, it was like a magazine on a disc with educational games and stuff. So you are a huge collector of these.
Are you saying that there are people listening to the show who don't know what Microzine is?
It's conceivable, but
they can just stop. They can.
I
leave.
Can tell you,
they can just hang
out. There's someone hosting this show who didn't know what Microzine was.
You are the weakest link.
Yeah, I know. Yep. Sorry.
Goodbye. Anyway, yeah, I grew up with these in my parochial school as a kid, and since I was one of the few students with an Apple II at home, they let me bring them home on the weekend, and I'd remember waking up Saturday morning before anybody else was awake, and I didn't have to compete with them to use the computer, and I would just be playing Microzine all morning. It was fantastic.
Sweet.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty cool. And actually, they, so it's educational, basically, educational software. It was a periodical, so, I mean, there were a lot of them. I have something like 40, I think, of the regular Microzine run. And it's only just quite recently that I think they've all made it, or at least very soon will have made it into the archives. There's just so many of them, and people, you know, they actually were relatively well protected against copying. So 4AM, the one version we've talked about doing the clean cracks of Apple II software, and particularly of kind of the educational titles that got left behind, is I think just about to finish up with the last couple of Microzines. And so that's quite an accomplishment, actually. So now everyone can actually wake up early Saturday morning and and play the little, you know, choose your own adventures or whatever. So yeah, it's neat. I'd never seen this box before. I've seen this box that Ken was referring to that he has with this the kit that holds 1 through 6, and it's pretty cool. I think actually the box, Ken, that you already have is cooler than this one, but I hadn't seen this one before either.
Well, that's what makes this one cool, is that we've never seen it before.
Yeah. Anyway, whatever. Okay, take a look at the auction. it's a neat box regardless. You can put, you know, whatever you want to in there. You can put a USB drive with all of the 4AM cracks of Microzine on it. Let's see, and I guess, so I'm up next. I have two things that are neither of them Apple II, so that's good. The first one I thought was pretty cool was this, it's a, I guess I will say, ZX81 kit computer. So I think probably we're all fairly familiar with the ZX81 and the Timex Sinclair 1000 that was the North American version of that. I was aware, you know, its predecessor, the ZX80, came in both a kit form, and I think it also came assembled. I did not realize that you could get the ZX81 as a kit, but this auction has actually a never assembled, you know, original kit version of the ZX81. So it's neat to see. It probably, so right now it's got one, you know, it's newly listed. It has a single bid, and it is $10. It's shipping from Colorado, so I don't know how it wound up on this side of the ocean, but and I expect this is going to go for quite a lot. It'll still be going. It's got 9 days left as we're recording this, so might be worth taking a look at if it's possible that nobody notices it. And no one else listening to this goes in on it. It'll go for cheap, but my guess is that this will ultimately fetch quite a lot. But it's cool to see. I have a couple of the assembled ones, and they're quite underpowered computers, but probably more fun if you built it yourself.
Yeah, probably much so.
Have either of you ever used either the Timex Sinclair or the ZX computers?
I never actually
have. Not, I'm sorry.
I just remember in school that like the one kid who had like at home the Timex Sinclair 1000, like that was the one kid you felt sorry for.
Right.
And that was even coming from me who had an Atari 400 at home. Like, I felt like that kid's got it bad.
Yeah. Yeah, they're, I have not played with them very much. They're terrible to type on.
Mm.
Because it's like the Atari 400, you know, it's just like a membrane keyboard.
Right.
And they're a little lightweight. They're little tiny things.
Yeah.
But, anyway, pretty cool. Very retro. Okay, so what's the other one? The other one, so I don't know much about this at all, but it caught my attention when I was looking through the listings. It's a Thomson ML5 home computer, 1 megahertz, 6809E CPU. So it is a computer I had never heard of. Apparently, it was actually primarily something from France. It was a computer that didn't get marketed much outside of France, but it was supposed to kind of compete with the Spectrum and things, and maybe also the Commodore 64. I had some link open to a page about this. So I'd never heard of it before. It looks kind of cool. It looks like it has some kind of SCART connector on it or something, which I think would make it relatively easy to connect to modern monitors, although I don't have anything that can handle SCART here.
But, in Europe, that's extremely common. So even if you buy a brand new top-of-the-line LED TV today, it's got some kind of SCART connectivity always.
Excellent. Cool. This also seems to have somehow made it to this side of the ocean. So this one's coming from Missouri. So this is a buy it now. It's available for a month still as we're recording this. I don't know how long it'll last. It's actually, it doesn't seem too expensive for the degree of weird this is. But it's a buy it now of $80. So 6809E CPU is, you know, a version of the 6809, which I think was that in
the Cocoa?
I think it might have been. Yeah, it was. I think that's true. I think it was in the Cocoa. Because I remember looking into the 6809 a little bit and thinking that might have been a kind of a fun processor to play with.
Right.
But cool. Anyway, so if anyone has any experience, I suppose probably people who were in France when this was new might have come across these before. I'm kind of curious about it myself, but possibly not enough. Not enough to buy it out from under you, the listener, but only just barely, because it is pretty cool. Okay. So I guess that's all I had for this round of eBay. And I guess that's actually basically it. We can turn to the closing discussions and things to add. Jack seems to have a tiny thing to say.
I do have one tiny thing to say. So this summer, I was traveling a bit, and I had some various like travel mishaps that I'm not going to go into now. But all my travel mishaps led to something happening this morning, this very morning. I woke up from a troubling dream. In my dream, I was in a hurry to get to an airport, and I didn't have my boarding card, and I was waiting at the check-in counter, and the woman at the check-in counter was not in a hurry because I was going to Minnesota and she wanted to talk to me about Minnesota. I was like, oh my God, come on. But then later and it was terrible. And I woke up like before this was resolved. Like I never got to the plane nor missed the plane. It was just really trouble, the whole thing. But then later after I woke up, I remembered that the real reason I was late to the airport in the first place was because I was somehow distracted somewhere along the way by an Atari 400 that was for sale somewhere, and I started negotiating to buy, and that made me late for the whole thing. So that's sort of the moral of this story, is don't let your obsession with old computers make you miss an airplane.
Okay.
That's it. That's all I got.
Nice. Nice. Ken, you have anything interesting going on in the near future?
In the near future?
Recent
no,
past.
No. In the far future, I'm going to Kansas Fest 2016.
Ooh. Yeah, that's what we need, is a whole year lead-up discussion Kansas Fest so that we can...
We should talk about it on every episode of this show. It can be the Kansas Fest podcast.
The countdown to Kansas
Listeners,
Fest.
Listeners, you may weigh in on that idea.
No, I got nothing going on. Actually, I've been really inspired ever since this past Kansas Fest. I have a blog that I update every Monday with something about the Apple II world, and usually Sunday night I'm scrambling trying to think of something to say. But ever since Kansas Fest, I am generally 6 to 8 weeks in advance of my post. Like, I've had all of September written for the last 2 weeks, and it's great that I can just relax Sunday night and know that there's already something queued up, because there, I don't know if there's just a lot happening in the Apple II world or out in the general public that I'm, or maybe I'm just more aware of these things, but writing about the Apple II never seems to have been easier.
Interesting. Well, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a, you know, long dormant blog that I keep meaning to try to add to. I think maybe that's what I'll try to do. But yeah, no, I'm, you know, as we sort of said at the outset, the onset of the academic year is kind of dominating a lot of my time. Although actually,
yes,
some of that is being dominated by my trying to clean up my office to make it presentable to like students. because my academic office is actually where I have all my retro stuff. So, although I made an excellent discovery yesterday, which is that I have a bunch of file cabinets, and turns out actually most of those drawers are empty. So part of the reason that my office looks like such a disaster is I had sort of been periodically taking things out of the drawers in order to like do stuff with them and then forgetting to put them back. So fortunately, I think it's quite possible I can hide much of this stuff. But anyway, yeah, other than just kind of like sifting, I don't have much going on either. Okay, I guess that's about it. That's a relatively long show anyway. So that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum, some place that I actually have not visited anytime recently, but I will also try to join you there. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net. And please write a review on iTunes. That'll help people find the show and remind us not to do Apple II all the time. So I guess until next time,
Retro Compute!